This presentation has been previously broadcast.
The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show.
On Relevant Radio.
I was in two Ubers. The first one was playing a Rihanna song that called Rude Boy. And it is pornography. The things that they're describing, I mean, there's just no hiding anything. And obviously, this is presented as women's empowerment with this guy who obviously doesn't have any idea of virtue and chastity.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back to the Drew Mariani Show. I'm Sheila Logminas in for Drew today. That was Catherine Jean Lopez you just heard. She was my guest just before the last break. She was my guest for better part of the last hour, and we were talking about life issues and how a peaceful procession that starts with mass in New York and then followed by a 7-block walk and rosary to a Planned Parenthood clinic, that's all they do, were getting harassed by people who were advocating, not just advocating, activating for abortion. So they were getting harassed and they were getting called terrible names. And so they needed police protection, and that made a 7-block walk 2 hours long. But they were witnesses to life, and that was Catherine just talking as she does in her column. She puts it in black and white. Beautiful messages about what we're trying to do, how we need to change our message very often to even be heard. And even when, you know, people try to drown us out or shout us down, we won't be stopped. We just need to know how to change the message. A lot of people don't. If you're pro-life, but you just don't know how to answer some of these smackdowns or shoutdowns or challenges, there's a lot of help for that as well. I know there are a lot of issues out there, and some people say, well, are you talking about abortion again? Oh, you bet, because the abortion industry is, and they call us anti-choice. So they're misusing language. We need to use the language with the right tone and the right message, and we need to use it truthfully. So while there are a lot of concerns out there, family, healthcare, education, social policy, jobs, of course, and our ability to carry out our mission in our work and in our daily lives, part of that is exactly the issue, the most important issues of the day, and the deeper dive into what you're not hearing elsewhere. Well, on that note, bring together education, family, the concerns about our children and what they're learning in school, being taught, being exposed to, as Catherine was exposed to that music she described in a cab. So when you send your 10-year-old son to school, you send him with his books or notepads or whatever else he needs for learning, but you probably don't have, oh gosh, here we go. You probably don't have things like condoms on your mind. Yeah, sorry. Unfortunately, the Chicago Public School Department, my town is in the news again for something egregious. The Chicago Public School Department does, unfortunately, this condoms under a new regulation. And they're going to be providing all schools with kids in grades 5 through 12 with condoms and menstrual products. According to Dr. Kenneth Fox, the school's top physician, when you don't have those protections, this is a quote, when you don't have those protections and don't make those resources available, then bad stuff happens to young people. You have elevated risks of sexually transmitted infections, of unintended pregnancies, and that's very preventable stuff. We'll talk about lowering expectations, my gosh. So this action comes despite the fact that the age of consent in Illinois, like all states, is 16. Remember when it was 18, not very long ago? So if a 10-year-old thinks he needs to be using condoms, something is seriously wrong on a number of levels. According to liveaction.org, a meta-analysis of studies on sex education programs in schools showed, quote, little evidence that programs are effective at producing positive impact on their participants. We probably could just intuit that, close quote. In fact, only 6 out of 103 had evidence of real effectiveness without negative effects year after year or after year. Yet, there was no evidence that these 6 successful studies led to increased consistent condom usage, teen abstinence, fewer instances of sexually transmitted diseases, or fewer teen pregnancies. Meanwhile, 16 studies actually showed negative effects on teen sexual behavior and sexual health, including increases in teen sexual activity and other risky behaviors. Well, joining me now is Steve Carlin, the co-author of 40 Days for Life and Sean Carney's book, What to Say When. That's literally the name of the book, What to Say When. Steve, welcome to the program. I'm so glad you're here. We so need the book, What to Say When. And it's not even What to Say When, dot, dot, dot. It's What to Say When, period. Like, What to Say When, and everybody knows what the when is. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. Glad to be with you today.
It's great to have you in, and we all need to know what to say when, what. Confronted by the challenges, by the threats, by the, oh, you don't care about the women. Everything they've got, they throw at pro-lifers. You only care about the baby, you don't care about the woman, and once the baby's born, you don't even care about the baby. We've heard it all. So tell us about the book, first of all, what you and Sean Carney put into What to Say When.
Well, we wanted to provide an updated apologetics of the pro-life movement book out there because, you know, there's new data all the time, there's new evidence, there's new research coming out, and one of the things that we have really found is that pro-lifers, Christians, Catholics, people of good faith, we have this natural intuition and understanding that abortion is wrong. It's the least academically complex position you might take to say you just don't kill an innocent baby. Everybody in their heart knows that. But when they are, you know, out on the streets, perhaps praying in front of an abortion facility, or they're sitting in their college campus lecture hall, or they're at Thanksgiving and they've got the belligerent uncle who's talking about his pro-choice talking points. Sometimes it can get really difficult when we start getting into the weeds to talk mm-hmm. about, you know, how do you respond to my body, my choice? How do you respond mm-hmm. to the rape and incest argument? How do you respond to all of these talking points? And we wanted to give pro-lifers the confidence in being able to articulate the pro-life position whenever and wherever they may be called on their convictions.
Is Steve, part of that is just understanding how to talk to people about what the church teaches about human flourishing, what the church teaches about, you know, men and women and male and female and boys and girls and so forth. And I know this is not the direction we're going in right now, but this is a quick aside. I couldn't believe an article I read the other day, and it wasn't even in The Onion. It was really an article about the American Booksellers Association came out just all over social media and all over whatever media they could grab onto with just falling all over themselves with profuse apologies the other day to the, what, I guess the trans world, I'm not sure, but to whoever they insulted, saying that in their annual summer boxes of books that they send out to bookstores all over the country of books, new books coming out, new books that they're putting out, Bookseller Association, what this box of books contain, including in it a new book called Girls and Boys. And so when you have to apologize, and they said, we know we can't even apologize enough because of the harm we know we've done and the offenses we know we've caused to people who will be deeply pained, and so on and so on it went. And Steve, that was simply because they were saying that, I guess, trans people, I'm not sure who all they were apologizing to, and they assured everyone they would pull that book immediately. So to that point, people don't kind of know what to say because they're kind of afraid to say anything. And now we have the Chicago Public School Department chief physician, Dr. Kenneth Fox, saying, when you don't have condoms in schools and things for girls in ages in grades 5 through 12, and you don't have those, he called, protections, and don't make those, he called, resources available, then bad stuff happens to young people. Well, so too does it when they aren't properly even taught in the first place or prepared to be in that kind of environment. And I know you address this as well. So when Dr. Fox talked about stuff happening to young people, sexual activity isn't something that just mysteriously happens to anyone. What's he talking about?
Yeah, this is he thinks bad stuff happens when you don't have condoms in the schools for fifth graders. Imagine what we will see, what kind of bad things will take place when we do have condoms in the schools with fifth graders. But this, I think, is ultimately, it's a part of the continuing effort to break down the parent-child relationship, to undermine parental authority, to take those decision-making, those decisions being made and the authority out of the parent's hands. And at that point, anything goes, right? There's a lot of arguments being made by those in favor of this plan saying, you know, providing condoms does not encourage their use among fifth graders. But you take a look at it, and that sort of mentality, that logic doesn't apply anywhere else in society. You've seen municipalities all over the country banning Happy Meals at McDonald's, suggesting if you give away a toy along with the cheeseburger, that encourages obesity. I mean, imagine if you were to hand out guns to students and say, well, we're not encouraging their use. It's just absurd. And in many ways, it makes it difficult to argue with the position, because if you're dealing with folks who are making a case on good faith, you can kind of find what are our points of disagreement. What are the fundamental places where we differ in our values? And this is a case where we're just in outright denial of reality.
It's such an outright denial of reality, Steve, that when I read that, I thought, wait a minute, when Dr. Kenneth Fox, Chicago Public Schools top physician, says, when you don't, oh my gosh, under this new regulation, when you don't give out condoms to kids in grades 5 through 12, when you don't, he said, have those protections and resources available, then bad stuff happens to young people. I thought, well, first of all, so this is dumbing down and lowering expectations on children in the first place, instead of like raising them up to a higher level of teaching and learning about the human person. And when you do that, it's not just abstinence education. That's somehow along the years, right, Steve, it picked up its own sort of bad reputation, just using abstinence education. Well, like, you know, the just say no to drugs. None of these things worked with kids. So when what we really ought to be doing is what, Steve? Teaching them what they were made for and elevating them to their own discipline, self-discipline, right? Isn't that what John Paul II did? Really told young people at World Youth Day what God created them for, what they're made for, what they're meant for, the higher calling they can make. I mean, it ennobles you. It gives you your dignity. It helps you see the dignity in others. And that's what we ought to be teaching the children in schools.
Teaching in the schools and living it out at home as well.
I was talking with
a friend of mine who is a principal in a public school, and all sorts of problems along the lines of these moral failings that we're discussing. And I asked him, I said, as you see this brokenness, the crime in the schools, the sexual activity at young ages, I said, what is the common thread? Is it is it alcohol in the homes? Is it? He just looked at me and he stopped me and he said, when there's no father in the home, these problems take place. And he said, I am not allowed to say that. I will lose my job if I say that. But we need dads modeling manly, like true, authentic, masculine behavior in the home. And the children, both boys and girls, they take such a key message that's sent. No one else can send it like a father. And that's where we see healthy young people and healthy families.
Yeah, and yet, I mean, so for a very long time, we've been covering that. I've been covering that on my shows about the fatherlessness. And, one of my conversations with a particular psychologist, really well known, does a lot of work in that field, Steve. And he said that we were being listened to, because Relevant Radio was everywhere. And it was being listened to, that show that day, by a prisoner in, I think, a California prison. And that's where my guest was, in California. And he was listening, and he wrote him, and he wanted to know how he could get a letter to that doctor. And so the call screener gave him some sort of an address the doctor gave for that purpose. And he wrote him an 8-page handwritten letter, Steve. And he talked, this prisoner did, and he talked about how he and many of the men in prison with him, in their own conversations within those walls, talked about the daddy deficit. They called it the daddy deficit, and the impact that had on why they were there, why they were incarcerated, what they did, and the impact fatherless homes had on them and has on society, and how glad he was this was being talked about, but that he wanted to see that prevented as much as possible for other boys who have a chance to avoid what happened to him. So this is what you say. It's so true. And yet some people feel exactly that they can't say it in public, or they'll lose their job, they'll lose their reputation will be smeared, their children will suffer. What can turn that around? Well, for one thing, your book, What to Say When. Is there a sort of a key besides having the right tone so that whatever you say is going to be heard?
Tone is certainly important, but I think just the fortitude of being willing. You don't need to be an expert in all of these different topics, whether it's contraception or whether it's abortion. You don't need to be an expert. You simply need to know a few basic facts, the type of information that we already know. So, for example, when we talk about contraception or handing out condoms in high school, it can be very helpful to know that, you know, Kaiser Permanente, one of the biggest hospital systems in the country, estimates that the typical use failure rate for people who use condoms is 18% over the course of a year. 18%, that's almost one in five going to fail. And I mean, now we're talking children. When my oldest son was in fifth grade, he forgot his basketball shoes to go to his basketball game. So you're going to see a much higher typical failure rate. And so I think that's the type of thing you don't necessarily need to remember the number 18%, but when the average person is told about, well, you know, we do need to protect children, they're going to have sex anyway, we need them to have safe sex, and you can pull out the number, you know, 1 in 5 times over the course of a year, you're going to see that method fail, and pregnancy will result perhaps for a fifth grade girl, or you may see a sexually transmitted disease take place. All of those bad things that Dr. Fox is looking to prevent, all of those things are going to come forth in greater numbers than ever before.
Indeed. And in fact, so you know what, right? We, as we well know in the pro-life world, that the abortion industry will just say anything and everything about pro-lifers. And so 40 Days for Life, which, you know, you've been together with Sean Carney, a member of, being a pro-life organization, can you just imagine Planned Parenthood saying something like, well, why are you so concerned about this? About the,
well,
you know, go ahead.
Yeah, from the pro-life perspective, I mean, we see the Guttmacher Institute, a pro-abortion think tank, estimates that 224,000 abortions were the result of condom failure. That means that the abortions just as a result of condom failure would be the third leading cause of death in the country, behind only heart disease and cancer. So I think all pro-lifers should be very concerned. We hear so often, we get used to hearing this idea that, well, if you're really pro-life, you should be in favor of condoms because that will prevent the unwanted pregnancies that lead to abortion. But then you've got folks like Dr. Edward Greene, who was a senior research scientist at Harvard Public Health, and he really made headlines when he agreed with Pope Benedict a number of years ago, saying, you know what, actually, the data shows that when you provide condoms, the risky behavior increases such that any possible public health benefit from those condoms disappears. These things aren't really making a lot of headlines, but this isn't a religious source. It's not an article of faith. This is a Harvard scientist who's coming out and saying, look, the data shows that condoms are not effective. They're going to lead to more sexually transmitted diseases. And we believe that they lead to more abortions, as the Guttmacher Institute report suggested.
So, Steve, do you think Planned Parenthood is behind a move like this?
Oh, 100%. We see it in the way Planned Parenthood responds to any situation anywhere. It's that old adage that when the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. And maybe I got that wrong. Forgive me if I did.
No.
But we see
actually,
a hurricane,
right,
an earthquake, any natural disaster, any man-made disaster. They're not sending bottled water. They're not sending humanitarian aid. They're sending condoms. So I think we can see that this is just the modus operandi that is repeated over and over again.
And they're also sending abortion pills. Dr. Fox, the Chicago Public School Department's chief physician, in saying that, again, when you don't have these condoms for kids in grades 5 through 12, then you're going to make those resources available. Then bad stuff happens. And he, just for those who tuned in, he said, you've elevated the risk of sexually transmitted infections, unintended pregnancies, and that's very preventable, he says. Therefore, they are adding those condoms and menstrual products in resources, as they call them, resources, for kids in grades 5 through 12 in Chicago public schools. Can't believe it. So I'm talking, if you just tuned in with, I'm Sheila Logminas in for Drew, talking with Steve Carlin, co-author with Sean Carney of 40 Days for Life, of the book, What to Say When. Right now, in a couple of minutes that we have, I just wanted to ask you, Dr. Fox wants to prevent pregnancy. We already agreed this is just going to add fuel to that fire and increase pregnancy. So with all this happening in public education that's so wrong, should parents just pull their children out, do you think, Steve, and put them elsewhere or educate them themselves?
I mean, it's hard to offer a one-size-fits-all prescription like that. Certainly, I lived in the Chicago Public School District. I absolutely would not be sending my kids to a school that's giving out free condoms. But, you know, I think parents need to be involved in their education, whether it's public, whether it's private, whether it's parochial, or whether it's homeschooling. Parents, I don't think, can afford to just sort of outsource the education of their children to someone else. They need to take an active role in it. And if that involves a public school or other type of school, they need to know what is being taught, how is it being taught, at what ages is it being taught, and is it in conflict with the truths about the nature of the human person that we believe as people of faith.
And can people expect to see things like that in your book with Sean Carney, What to Say When?
Well, we don't get too deep into the question of which schools should folks go to, but we do really talk about a lot of these issues. We talk about the connection between abortion and contraception. We talk about the connection between abortion and artificial methods of reproduction, sort of on the flip side. And I think it's going to be a resource that parents can use both, you know, with their children or in any conversation where abortion comes up.
Steve Carlin, thank you so much. The book is What to Say When with Sean Carney, 40 Days for Life. Steve, thank you.
Thank you so much. God bless you. Thanks for having me.
You as well, and thank you for writing that book.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
We have work to do until we get rid of the Hyde Amendment once and for all.
It's the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back to the Drew Mariani Show. I'm Sheila Logminas in for Drew today. So glad I'm here. Time flies. Drew says that every day. And it certainly is true. It's just the truth of the matter. It flies. It goes so fast. It's been full show today covering the issues that are most important to all of us and the heart of the matter on each one. Dive deeper beyond what you hear, in other media and in headlines even, and find out what's the truth. Sometimes you see reports out, there's a new study, there's a new survey, there's a new poll about abortion. And guess what? The poll will tell you. People are becoming more and more pro-choice. Not so. And my next guest is here to clarify that for you. Michael New is a research associate at the Bush School of Business at the Catholic University of America and an associate scholar at the Charlotte Lozier Institute. Michael puts out columns and posts every week and sometimes twice a week, I think, or three times a week. As often as there's a new poll out there, Michael's out there to jump on it and say, all right, here's what the poll said and here's what the truth is. And he's done so again now. So I'm really eager to talk about that and the Hyde Amendment. You want to talk about the Hyde Amendment? 888-914-9149. I and Michael very ready to talk about the Hyde Amendment. Michael, welcome here. It's wonderful to have you in and talk about that in the latest poll.
Oh, thanks for having me. Much appreciated.
You know, these polls, Michael, just never reflect the full truth. They're always spun. So, you know, we know Guttmacher was affiliated with Planned Parenthood. And whether or not they still are in some way connected, the fact is, my question for you, I guess, is, instead of making it a fact, how reliable are Guttmacher polls?
Well, Guttmacher, by and large, is interested in kind of health research as such. I think, again, they're a group that has a very strong pro-abortion bias, a group that has a very strong pro-contraception bias. I don't think they do a great deal of polling on abortion as such. But again, I think that any time one reads a Guttmacher press release or is listening to a Guttmacher spokesperson on the radio or on TV or in print media, one should just be very skeptical. I mean, this is not a group that's objective. Up until 2006, 2007, they were the research arm of Planned Parenthood, and I think that their claims just deserve a great deal of skepticism.
Yeah, they do. They, in fact, it's how they ask the questions. It's what questions they ask and how they ask them. And then when they report, Americans, you know, favor this or favor that. Michael, you and I know, and we report all the time, that even people who self-identify as pro-choice don't tend to want their tax dollars to pay for it. So, you know, we all pay taxes. We don't want, even people who are pro-choice don't want those tax dollars to go to fund abortions. And that remains the case, right, Michael? So when you factor that in, more Americans oppose that than favor fine abortion on demand, let tax dollars pay for it. Americans tend to not want that at all.
Now, absolutely. I mean, we've seen, you know, at least 9 polls taken in the past 4 years. And these have been polls conducted by different survey research firms. They've used different question wording, and the results are clear. I mean, every poll I've seen on the question of taxpayer funding for abortion, at least a plurality says they don't want their taxpayer dollars going for abortion. And I think at 9 of the most recent polls I looked at, 8 of those 9, a majority said they don't want their taxpayer dollars going to pay for abortion. So taxpayer funding for abortion polls very poorly. It also polls very poorly amongst a wide range of demographic groups. It's not just Republicans. Independents don't want to see their tax dollars paying for abortion. Even a significant percentage of Democrats aren't in favor of this either. So it's not just a Republican-conservative pro-life issue. There's a very strong consensus that Americans don't want their taxpayer dollars paying for abortion.
Well, therefore, we need to keep making people aware of this. So, Michael, your latest or one of your latest articles, headline, it's been a record-setting year for pro-lifers so far. So pro-lifers, take heart, because you are doing a very good job in making that happen. It's a record-setting year for you, for us, for those of us who stand for life and who witness for life. And Michael New, in your article in National Review, earlier, you say, speaking of Guttmacher Institute, this poll is different. It's not even a poll. It's a policy analysis. Earlier this month, pro-abortion research group, and they are pro-abortion, as you say, Guttmacher Institute, released a policy analysis. Now, this is interesting. It's not a poll. It's a policy analysis. And they called it the worst legislative year ever for U.S. abortion rights. What did that policy analysis say?
Yeah, this should be music to the ears of pro-lifers. At any time Guttmacher's upset, we should be happy. And we deserve to be happy because we're doing great work at the state level. So far in 2021, there have been 90 state-level pro-life laws that have been passed. 90. That is a new record. The previous record was 89, set back in 2011. But what's interesting is that in 2011, we were really playing defense. 2011 was the first calendar year after the Affordable Care Act was passed. So we were passing a lot of defensive laws, trying to protect the conscience rights of healthcare workers, trying to make sure that the subsidized plans available through the exchanges did not cover abortion. But now in 2021, we're playing offense. We've seen a number of states pass gestational age limits. We've seen states like Texas pass trigger laws that would ban abortion in the case of Roe v. Wade being overturned. We've seen states' laws placing regulations on the availability of chemical abortion drugs. We've seen states pass laws that protect unborn children born after failed abortions. So, again, we're really doing great in the law of the states, and I think this is a great reason for a celebration.
Well, so let's talk about the ways, different ways, because what you just said, you went through a number of different ways pro-life laws are passing, whether it's parental notification, whether it's the pain-capable age, there are just so many incremental ways that pro-life laws can be passed, and that's kind of what the pro-life movement has had to do, is find ways that they can get anything passed to help women save babies and save women from more devastation. So talk about that, because when you say most of the pro-life laws enacted this year represent substantive efforts to protect preborn children, when you name the six states enacted gestational age limits on abortion. So this is how it's more successful, right? To go at it in hearts and minds, letting people know what the age when a baby in the womb can feel pain. I mean, that's one way, gestational age limits in abortion. And outlawing abortion in event that Roe v. Wade is overturned and decisions about abortion policy return to the state. That's another one. In the South Dakota, governor signing legislation protecting preborn children who have been diagnosed with Down syndrome. My gosh, the ways that pro-lifers have been successful, as you said earlier, Michael, proliferate. But talk about the ways that these are all very creative ways to go at it. Why certain states, certain measures, and other states, other measures?
A lot of it depends on just the timing and circumstances of what legislation is of most interest to legislative leaders in these states. But I think a variety of approaches is a good idea for a pretty wide range of reasons. First off, the Supreme Court, whether folks like to admit it or not, is impacted by politics and is impacted by public opinion. And I think it's important to show that in certain parts of the country, there is strong political support for really substantive pro-life laws that really would protect preborn children, that we're just not content to tinker at the margin here and there. We want really substantive laws in place, that would legally protect the preborn. And I think that's a very important signal to send with the Supreme Court considering the Mississippi 15-week abortion ban case coming up this fall. Another thing is that, right now on the Supreme Court, I would say we have six judges who I would say are abortion skeptical. And I think the key for pro-lifers is to find a case where they can all agree on. I hope and pray this Mississippi case is that case, but it may not be. But we just need to keep sending cases up to the Supreme Court until we get a favorable ruling. Again, it may be the Mississippi case might be the one that overturns Roe v. Wade. It may be a case that lets us do more to protect the preborn. But it might be some other cases in the pipeline now. So, passing a variety of different kinds of laws, I think is a very wise strategy for pro-lifers at the state level.
You know, Michael, recently, like I said, you put out many articles, and when there's a poll out, when there's a policy analysis out, you cover it. And recently, you covered one when Gallup, so now instead of Guttmacher, Gallup released results of their annual poll on sanctity of life issues. You said, unsurprisingly, a number of media outlets were at the time aggressively, this wasn't very long ago, aggressively spinning those results to argue that there's been an increase in public sentiment, as we said, in favor of legal abortion. But in fact, you said there's a record high 47% of Americans who view abortion as record high as morally acceptable. That's getting a lot of attention in the media. Excuse me. Whereas you point out, Gallup asked many questions involving abortion. And when you consider the entire survey, again, back to what's asked and how is it asked, there's actually a slight decrease in the percentage of Americans who wanted to see Roe v. Wade upheld. So how can that be spun to say by Gallup or anybody else that there are more Americans who view abortion as morally acceptable?
You know, the main theme of that Gallup poll is just stability. Gallup, again, asked many, many questions about attitudes towards sanctity of life issues, and I think a lot of mainstream media outlets just cherry-picked one result which they liked. There was a bit of an increase in the percentage of Americans who found abortion to be morally acceptable. I think that figure was 47%. And no, that was not a good finding. But you have to look at the whole poll and the answers to all the questions. And the question they ask that gets the most attention, and I think is probably the most important, is a simple question: are you pro-life or pro-choice? And when you look at the average of the five previous Gallup polls, they found that 47% of Americans identified as pro-life. In this Gallup poll, they found the exact same finding. 47% of Americans identify as pro-life. So the main theme here was just stability. There were some wiggles here and there on certain questions. But when we look at the totality of the results, you find a lot of stability, that the pandemic and other things we've gone through really have not changed public attitudes toward abortion all that much.
Well, that's good, and it's good to see even incremental increases in people who favor restrictions of some sort in their various states, and there are increasing numbers of those. That's what you've most recently reported on. However, we're in that time period, Michael, where we're hearing more and more out of Washington, and especially Congress, and especially the House, on the Hyde Amendment going down, the Hyde Amendment like being done away with. All these years of the Hyde Amendment being totally bipartisan and so acceptably bipartisan, we know we're in different times now. We know it's hard to get anything through Congress that's not straight party line. And yet that used to be that way since Henry Hyde was, you know, so nobly and honorably in his position in the House of Representatives. So what do you see happening? What do you see as the future of the Hyde Amendment? Because I know the GOP, especially in the House, are trying everything they can think of and putting them into legislative propositions, at least, whether they get anywhere or not, to protect the Hyde Amendment.
Well, I mean, right now we need to be concerned. We don't need to despair, but there are reasons for concern that a appropriations bill that did not include the Hyde Amendment did pass the Appropriations Committee on Thursday in a party line vote, 33-25. There was an amendment to include the Hyde Amendment that failed, 27-32. Representative Cuellar, who's a Democrat representing Texas, he did vote in favor of that amendment, which we appreciate, but he did vote for the entire appropriations bill, which did not include Hyde, so that was disappointing. Republicans tried very hard. There was a lot of debate on Hyde. Republicans spoke very eloquently. I do want to highlight Representative Ashley Hinson, who represents the 1st District of Iowa. She actually used my research and discussed the amount of lives saved by the Hyde Amendment in every state. Saved over 40,000 lives in Iowa, nearly 3,000 lives in Connecticut, over 47,000 lives in Oklahoma, and it saved approximately 2.4 million lives since 1976. So we couldn't save the Hyde Amendment in the committee. So it'll go to the House floor for a vote. And, you know, it's not looking good, but it's not impossible. The partisan margins in the House are thin. Right now, Democrats have a 9-seat advantage. So we can flip 5 Democrats. We can save the Hyde Amendment. I think that we have a much better chance in the Senate. There's a 50-50 split, with Kamala Harris casting the tie-breaking vote. But you do have Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, who has pledged to support Hyde. I mean, he's not always reliable, but he does vote pro-life some of the time. You have had people like Senator Bob Casey of Pennsylvania and Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia, who at times have voted against tax-free funding of abortion. So I think we have a much better chance of saving and preserving the Hyde Amendment at the Senate. But again, we need to be very vigilant. We need to make this vote very visible. I think we need to make this, frankly, a career-ending vote for any Democrat or anybody else who votes against the Hyde Amendment. Again, people don't want their taxpayer dollars paying for abortion. We need to make this a big campaign issue. I mean, we need billboards, radio ads, TV ads, social media in their district more or less constantly from now until Election Day, reminding people that their congressman voted in favor of taxpayer funding for elective abortions.
You know, Michael, what occurs to me right now is in it, like anything else that's being covered. I mean, when people talk about abortion, the pro and con, the people who favor it and think it, you know, it's got to be kept legal on demand at all times. And those who say, no, this is extremely harmful to the very women, much less their babies. It's good to always, this is just a me thing. I mean, language and words. Words have so much power. So it's always good to clarify and to bring clarity to what the topic even is. So if you're talking about fatherhood, like fatherless homes that I was talking about earlier, what is fatherhood in the first place? What's good fatherhood? And when you do that, then you can more easily, you know, debate it or talk about it or talk about its importance in society. Similarly, abortion. Well, what is abortion? What does it do? What happens in an abortion? And in this case, we're talking about the Hyde Amendment. And Michael New, I'm thinking of the listeners out there who may, and many of them may be fully aware of it, and many people may not even be aware. They hear it all the time, but what is the Hyde Amendment? Where did it come from? Before you go there, this is a tease. How long has it been there? And most importantly, Michael New, you've said this on my program many times now, what the Hyde Amendment has done in the time it was law. And until it's overturned, it's going to continue to do this. I know, Michael New, you have the answers to what the Hyde Amendment is and what it can do while it stays a matter of law. Michael New will tell you that next.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
Get caught up on that conversation you missed by going to the Relevant Radio archives. Just select The Drew Mariani Show.
Welcome back to the Drew Mariani Show. I'm Sheila Logmanis in for Drew. Time is flying. I'm talking with Michael New, Research Associate at the Bush School of Business at the Catholic University of America. He's also Associate Scholar at the Charlotte Lozier Institute. He covers so many great and important, they sound like policy wonk things, right? When you see polls that cover abortion statistics, abortion sentiment among Americans, how do they feel now? Take the pulse of Americans about their taxpayer dollars funding abortion, about incremental laws protecting life in different states in different ways, whether it's gestational age for abortion or whether it's parental notification or something else. And there are many of those successes across the states. Michael was just reporting that in the last segment. But we were right now talking about the Hyde Amendment. And before we went to break, I brought up how many people don't know what the Hyde Amendment even is, much less, okay, if they do know, they don't know what it has done in all the years it has been law. And now that it's about to possibly go away from being law, in other words, be struck down by the party in power, by the president himself and his administration and those who control the House, Michael's talking about that. And so, Michael, as I said before, we want people to know what the Hyde Amendment is, how long it has been in effect, what it has done in the time it has been, and I want to invite listeners to ask you their questions as well. The phone lines are open, 888-914-9149. Michael, tell people what the Hyde Amendment is and what it's done.
Sure. You have to kind of go back to the mid-1970s. So Roe v. Wade was handed down by the Supreme Court, and pro-lifers realized that reversing Roe v. Wade was probably not going to happen in the short term. But we still want to do some things to protect whatever preborn children we could and protect the conscience rights of taxpayers. And what pro-lifers came up with was something called the Hyde Amendment. It was introduced by Congressman Henry Hyde, who represented Illinois. And what the Hyde Amendment does is it limits the ability of the federal Medicaid program to pay for abortion. You know, that we have a Medicaid program, provides health care or health insurance for low-income earners. And what the Hyde Amendment does is that it limits the ability of Medicaid, or at least the federal Medicaid program, to pay for abortion. So essentially, it gets the federal government out of the business of paying for elective abortions with taxpayer dollars. And essentially, just basic economics, that if abortion is free or very heavily subsidized, there's going to be more abortions. But if women have to pay for abortion out of pocket, there'll be fewer. And it's just sort of basic economics, basic supply and demand. So we know that essentially by getting the government out of the business of paying for abortion, abortion rates have gone down. And there's been, you know, a lot of research about this. I can cite at least 15 different studies in a wide range of academic journals, public health, economics, political science, showing the Hyde Amendment has saved lives. Center for Reproductive Rights, which is obviously a group that supports legal abortion, they did an analysis in 2010 that found the Hyde Amendment had saved over 1 million lives. And I did an analysis for the Charlotte Loser Institute, which was published in 2016, updated in 2020, which has found that since 1976, the Hyde Amendment has saved over 2.4 million lives. So there's 2.4 million people walking around a day who owe their lives to the Hyde Amendment. So please don't let anyone tell you that pro-life political efforts have been for naught by simply just getting the federal government out of the business of paying for elective abortions through the Medicaid program. We have saved millions of lives. So again, the Hyde Amendment is a great bill. It's a great piece of legislation. It has to be passed every year because it's part of the budget. It saves about 60,000 lives every year, and it's just, you know, tragic that a lot of these Democrats in the House are advancing an appropriations bill that does not include the Hyde Amendment.
In fact, you've written about this, how far back it goes, how much it's done, and as pro-lifers work to defend the Hyde Amendment, and as you noted earlier, Michael, Mississippi's 15-week abortion limit, we've got to move forward with confidence, but at the same time, vigilance. Our bishops, as Michael knew, is my guest right now, we're talking about the Hyde Amendment and how endangered it is. So there are people in the House working very hard. If that Hyde Amendment does get struck down, what can we do? What protection can be put in place, Michael, as you know, but I want people to know that the U.S. bishops on the USCCB, some of them have again urged House members to restore Hyde to the spending bill, particularly Archbishop Joseph Nauman of Kansas City, Kansas, chairman of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops Committee on Pro-Life Activities, and New York Cardinal Timothy Dolan, chairman of the USCCB's Committee for Religious Liberty. They have been imploring members of the House. They literally use that word. This is a quote. We implore the House Committee on Appropriations to reverse course on these bills that currently expand taxpayer funding of abortion. That's what the Democrats are doing in the House right now. And to restore the longstanding bipartisan Hyde provisions and the Weldon Amendment that have saved, as you said, Michael, millions of lives and protected conscience rights. Cardinal Timothy Dolan, Archbishop Joseph Nauman said that. And then they add this. These bills include many other provisions and funding for critically needed services that we support. They added Americans' tax dollars, should be used for the common good and welfare for all, not to finance abortion or force Americans to violate deeply held beliefs. Michael, by the way, what, tell listeners, is the Weldon Amendment?
Weldon Amendment is something that's also kind of passed in the appropriations bill. And what the Weldon Amendment does is it kind of protects the conscience rights of healthcare professionals. That it basically states that hospitals and other healthcare providers that, you know, don't want to perform abortions, participate in abortions due to religious reasons, they're still eligible for federal funding. So that's what the Weld Amendment does.
Well, we certainly are mortified to know that they're both in danger. It's hard to believe that they could be in the appropriations bill. They could be struck down or taken out. And the House Committee on Appropriations is poised to mark up the most, what the bishops call the most, this is a direct quote, the most extreme pro-abortion appropriations bill we have seen, close quote. Because it excludes the 46-year-old Hyde Amendment that Michael New and I are talking about and other longstanding bipartisan provisions that prevent tax money from being spent on abortion and take away conscience rights. So, Michael, it's all rolled up in this appropriations bill that has, by the way, as the bishops point out, other very, very good measures that we really want to help people and protect people, because that's just what the church does. But then when members of in politics, in government, start to add other things to slip them in there, that's when a bill kind of hits the skids. Is that just politics at work again here?
I think so, unfortunately. I mean, there's also a lot of this bill that we should be concerned about. I mean, the fact that has the Hyde Amendment's not part of it is obviously extremely troubling. This bill also includes a record amount of funding for the Title X program. It's actually $60 million more than President Biden requested, and a 39% increase from last year. And that's effectively a slush fund for abortion clinics, essentially. That, you know, Title X, you know, is supposed to be a program that pays for contraception, but a lot of the places that get Title X funds also perform abortions. And one good thing President Trump did was he limited the ability of Planned Parenthood and other abortion facilities from getting these Title X funds. President Biden is on the way to reversing that. And again, he's allocating, this budget allocates $400 million in Title X funding. That is money that abortion facilities are eligible for, and it's going to indirectly subsidize abortion. So that fact doesn't have the Hyde Amendment is bad. This increase in Title X funding, that's something we also need to be concerned about moving forward.
Well, we need to be concerned about all of these things, and therefore what, Michael? Therefore, what should people do who are listening right now? We should be concerned, but not just concerned. Take that concern into action. Does that mean contacting our members of government?
Absolutely. I mean, there's some websites I can give you. If you go to notaxpayerabortion.com, that's run by the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. They're keeping people posted. People should definitely call their congressman. The whole House is going to vote on this appropriations bill that does not include the Hyde Amendment. We want this bill voted down. You know, please call your member of Congress, even if it's a Democrat, even if it's someone who usually votes pro-abortion. You know, these people want to win re-election. A lot of them may not want to sacrifice their re-election chances to vote for a bill that supports taxpayer funding for abortion. Again, we have a chance to win in the Senate. You know, I think that our chances there are a lot better. Again, Joe Manchin of West Virginia, who's a senator, he has said that he would support Hyde. Again, we have to, you know, trust but verify with him lots of times. So, again, we don't need to despair, but we need to be vigilant. And certainly calling your congressman would be an excellent idea.
Well, thank you, Michael New. We need to be aware. We need to be educated, informed, aware, and then act. Thank you, Michael New, for helping us be all of those, be educated and ready to act. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
I just want to tell you folks, Thomas Jefferson said the care of human life and happiness and not their destruction is the first and only legitimate object of good government.